At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Who is more important to the American economy right now, Janet Yellen or Barack Obama? Discuss amongst yourselves. We'll be right back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 3rd of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. I am not, to be honest, all that big on anniversary news stories, but there is one today that's worth a mention, I think. Today marks 9 months to the day that Janet Yellen moved into the big office at the Federal Reserve. Today was also, just by happenstance, I am sure, the first time since then that she's had a chance to sit down with the guy who appointed her to the job. Meetings between the Fed chair and the chief executive aren't all that unusual. But as the second half of President Obama's last term begins with Election Day tomorrow, it is worth a minute to see what the Obama-Yellen economy might look like from here on out. Here's Marketplace's David Weinberg.
Historically, these face-to-face meetings happen for one of two reasons. Either the Fed chairman wants to brief the president on a big change in Fed policy, or, and this is the more likely scenario for today's meeting, says economist Mark Gertler, Yellen will update the president on the state of the U.S. economy.
She's going over to the president to give her assessment of the economy, and I doubt she's going over to talk about what she would like Obama to do.
So what does the economy look like, according to Janet Yellen? Based on her comments and Fed policy under her tenure, you could say that she sees an economy that's improving but still struggling to lower unemployment and stimulate wage growth.
Well, I think the key thing is her signaling of her concern for workers, for wages, for inequality, concern about inequality.
Gerald Epstein is chairman of the economics department at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Yellen's recent speech on inequality could be a sign that as Fed chairman, she will be looking especially closely at unemployment numbers when making monetary policy decisions.
Now, we normally think of the Fed as being the institutional shadow of the Fed chair. You say, you know, the Bernanke Fed or the Greenspan Fed.
But the reality, says financial historian Peter Conte Brown, is that the Fed is more like the Supreme Court. Its legal authority rests not in a single chairman, but in the Board of Governors and the presidents of the Reserve Banks. Together, they vote on Fed policy.
Now, Fed chairs, depending on their leadership style, either run roughshod over that committee structure, or they embrace the committee structure.
Conte Brown says Yellen has embraced the committee structure. And while she has been more outspoken than former Fed chairman on issues like income inequality, her actions have not deviated drastically from her predecessors. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We all know it's not really Janet Yellen's economy, right? Or Barack Obama's. It's yours. It's ours. So we've been asking the past couple of weeks for you to tell us what your economy looks like. Today, college student Daniel Cortez and his economy of the future.
You know, graduating at the time that I am leaves a lot of apprehension. You know, going to Rice University definitely prepared me for the job market, but not necessarily the one I feel that we're facing right now. You know, I look at my peers that studied engineering to go into the oil and gas market, and you know, I could only dream of making a salary like that. You know, hopefully by the end of my career, I'll be making as much money as they are. There are jobs in the public sector that are available for me, but the competition is very intense. We're not just competing with other students that are graduating right now, but we're competing with older workers, and we're also competing with people that graduated 5 years ago, and some of them have gone on to get masters or PhDs. There's definitely the sense that there's an arms race right now. You know, essentially, if you want to make it, you're having to commit a lot more just because, you know, these jobs are in such high demand that, you know, I think a lot of employers know that they could work these kids real hard. If they leave, there's going to be another guy that's just as smart and just as willing to take on the job. That's what's driving a lot of our fears and anxiety about the future.
Marketplace.org is the place that you can tell us what your economy is like. Take a second. Do let us know. On Wall Street today, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Details, numbers, you know the drill. There's a better than even chance that once all the votes are counted tomorrow night, we are still not going to know who won the Senate. Runoffs appear likely, if not nearly certain, in Georgia and Louisiana at least. And you know what that means, right? Yeah, more political journalism, can't get enough of that. Also, more straight politicking, and not just by candidates and parties either. 2014 so far has been the year that super PACs and political nonprofits and their money have moved fully in on turf that used to be reserved for the party apparatus. And not just advertising, but organizing and political messaging as well. Marketplace's David Gura explains what that is going to mean near term.
A super PAC called Next Gen Climate Action is bankrolled by billionaire Tom Steyer, and it's spent more than $5 million in Iowa alone. Some of that money has paid for ads.
What happens behind closed doors at a Koch-funded retreat? An Iowa Senate seat is on the auction block.
But Josh Friday, the group's chief operating officer, says most of it has gone toward field efforts.
We've really made a big effort to focus our resources into building grassroots infrastructure on the ground.
Steve Grubbs is a Republican political consultant based in Iowa, and he says other outside groups have been doing the same thing.
The job of campaigns and candidates has largely been outsourced.
Grubbs is the CEO of Victory Enterprises.
When I was state party chairman at the Republican Party of Iowa, all of the vote-by-mail or absentee ballot programs and get out the vote were generated through the state parties, maybe some of the candidate committees or local parties.
These days, super PACs and nonprofits do that kind of work, and some of them take the lead. Outside groups are building huge databases, and they're developing new tools to target voters.
I do think if I were chair of a party, I would have some significant concerns about it.
What's caused this, Grubbs argues, is candidates and state parties can't compete. There are restrictions on how much they can raise and how much they can spend. That's not the case for a group like Americans for Prosperity, a conservative nonprofit that spent $500,000 in Iowa. But Scott Brennan, the chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, says he's never run into anyone from any of the big outside groups, including Americans for Prosperity.
I'm sure AFP is not targeting the same people that the Iowa Democratic Party is targeting, but the bottom line is that, you know, they're not an enormous presence here.
Tim Hagel is a political science professor at the University of Iowa, who's on a lot of mailing lists, including Americans for Prosperities. And he opens up a message from Mark Lucas, the group's state director, bragging about its ground game.
I'm reading from his email. 35 paid staff and 5 field offices knocked on over 100,000 doors this year.
Hagel wonders what the growth of super PACs and nonprofits portends for parties.
So you do have to be careful of the downside to relying too heavily on some kind of outside group.
Parties could get rusty, he says. They could find themselves outmatched. Jim Nicholson used to chair the Republican National Committee. He says what worries him is parties have lost control of the message.
They, whoever they are, can do and say, you know, whatever they want.
Nicholson is from Colorado, where $67 million worth of outside money has flowed into the state's Senate race. Seth Maskett chairs the political science department at the University of Denver. He says the ads are pretty constant.
My impression is that most voters can't necessarily distinguish between an ad run by a candidate and one run by some unaffiliated interest group.
The race for governor in Colorado is also tight, and it illustrates Maskett's point beautifully. The two candidates agreed not to go negative, but that doesn't mean voters haven't been inundated with attack ads.
And don't forget, the John Hickenlooper comes with additional costs. There's a bad economy.
We can't give Bob Beaupre the power to be governor. Beaupre threatened to ban abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. And
if Maskett says we're witnessing politics evolve.
All these different groups are essentially part of a larger party network or an informal party.
Even if they can't coordinate, parties and sympathetic outside groups are on the same page. And there may be an upside to all this money being spent on getting out the vote. More Americans may vote. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Today's installment of Bigger is Often Better comes to us from the advertising industry. The French firm Publicis is buying the Boston-based digital company Sapient for a cool 3.7 billion American simoleons. The subtext here isn't really all that sub, to be honest. It is yet another play in the long game of ad agencies versus the Facebooks and Googles of the world. Stan Alcorn explains how that works.
As long as there have been ad agencies, there have been ad agency acquisitions, like the attempt to buy Don Draper's firm on Mad Men.
PPL is being sold and us along with it.
Oh.
So you knew about this?
No, but it makes sense.
It makes sense in part because it lets companies buy expertise. Kim Sheehan is a communications professor at the University of Oregon who worked at agencies in the 80s.
And when I was working in the industry, what we saw was advertising agencies buying smaller companies like direct marketing companies.
Sapient is a digital specialist, building websites and iPad apps, but it's also about where that expertise is located. Noah Elkin, executive editor at eMarketer, says North America is the biggest single advertising market in the world.
And within that market, the fastest growing segment is digital.
Publicis is buying a piece of that growth, as well as increasing its own size, which helps when negotiating ad rates with Google or Facebook.
Because you're buying in such a larger bulk that it enables you to get better terms.
But does all that justify the $3.7 billion price tag? Brian Weiser at Pivotal Research isn't so sure.
Skepticism that I have around the deal is not just the price paid, which is incredibly high, but the issue of opportunity cost.
He thinks instead of buying yet another agency, Publicis should have considered investing in the digital properties it already owns. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Tempting though it is, I will not label this next item this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. I will merely note that Billboard says Taylor Swift's new hit, Shake It Off, is the most played song on the radio right now. For those who use Spotify for their music source, however, good luck trying to find that song or anything else from Taylor Swift, in fact. She has pulled all of her music from the streaming service after having said artists should have more control over the pricing of their product. Nova Sappho reports that that is something of a major sticking point in a still-evolving online music industry.
There are three characters in the drama that is online music streaming. First, there's you, the consumer.
Consumers are not willing to pay that much for songs anymore.
Telecom analyst Roger Entner of Recon Analytics says after watching videos, streaming music is the most popular thing consumers do on mobile phones. But
they're not willing to pay, say, more than $10 a month, if even that.
There's an expectation for online songs to be free. That's according to Karen Allen, a digital music consultant. Allen says that's where the second character in the drama, the music streaming service, comes in.
That has been a challenge for all streaming services to find that magic offering for users where it's worth paying for and they're also getting value.
Spotify charges $5 or $10 a month, or it's free if you don't mind ads. And the company says it's reached 10 million subscribers. But Spotify also pays artists on average 0.7 cents per stream. Those artists and their music labels are the third character in the drama.
There's only three major labels left on the planet. They have tremendous leverage.
Casey Ray is with the Future of Music Coalition, which represents artists.
So I think that in some instances, you'll see these superstars using their clout as leverage. And sometimes that might mean taking your toys and going home.
But smaller artists, says Ray, have to go where the fans are. And the fans are inside the imperfect drama that is online music streaming. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think you can fairly say I spawned or laid an egg that has turned into a lifestyle industry.
Yeah. Martha Stewart, in case you didn't recognize the voice. But first, let's do the numbers. Bit of a pause on Wall Street today ahead of tomorrow's elections. And more importantly, thank you very much, Friday's jobs report. The Dow Industrials off 24 points, about a 10%, closed at 17,366. The NASDAQ up 8 points, nearly 0.2% there, 4638. The S&P 500, let's call it, yeah, flat, 2017. Here's the corporate news of the day. We told you about the French ad agency Publicis is buying Boston-based Sapient, which specializes in digital ads. Publicis shares off 2.25% on the day, but Sapient soared up 42%. Shares in the research company Covance Incorporated bumped up 26% today after the healthcare diagnostic firm Laboratory Corporation said it would buy Covance for more than $6 billion. Laboratory shares up, by the way, down more than 7%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for September. Alibaba has its first quarterly earnings report since its record-breaking IPO in September. And November is National Peanut Butter Lovers Month. Grab a spoon. Oh, wait. I mean, you know, just eat it however you want. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This has not been a spectacular couple of years for the cruise industry. There was the Costa Concordia, in which 32 people died, as well as many, many other less deadly but still horrible cruise debacles. And yet, somehow, the cruise industry is, shall we say, buoyant. Conrad Wilson reports.
Like most things, it depends on whom you ask. So let's start with the optimistic.
The cruise industry is proven to be continually popular and resilient after some kind of a, you know, a little bit of a tough period in the last few years.
That's Bob Chirac, president of his eponymous travel consulting company. He spent 20 years with the Cruise Lines International Association. And technically, he's right about growth. In 2012, 10.6 million Americans took a cruise, the number that inched up to 10.9 million last year.
There's an expectation that it's got to get better. And since that didn't happen this year, it should happen next year.
Maggie Rausch is an analyst with Focusrite, the travel industry research group behind those numbers.
Some of the optimism that you might be hearing is optimism that always exists this time of year for the coming year. Things are going to improve next year, kind of like when your team doesn't make the playoffs.
Rausch says the cruise industry is having a hard time increasing its customer base. She says even more than hotels or airlines, cruising relies heavily on repeat business.
Well, obviously the cruise lines welcome their business. In order to grow, they're always looking at how can we get people who haven't taken a cruise before to do so for the first time.
So far, this year has been without major incidents, meaning the industry might be able to get more folks on board. I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
Later this week in New York City, the winners of the 2014 American Made Awards will be announced. The winners will be people who make things, real things, everything from quilts to cookies to clothes, ideas that often become the seeds of successful small businesses. The awards are the brainchild of Martha Stewart, who knows a thing or two about starting up a business and really, in point of fact, helped create the entire lifestyle industry while she was at it. Martha Stewart, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We live in an age where high-tech companies make bajillions of dollars. High-tech entrepreneurs make the same amount of money, bajillions of dollars. And yet you are focusing on what has come to be called the maker culture, the crafts culture in this country. How come?
Well, because I think that there are many, many, many more makers than there are technologists who come up with that once-in-a-lifetime idea like Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. Those are rare occasions. But there are many, 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 many more people trying to do what satisfies them and actually satisfies a need and a want in the American public.
You see a value then beyond just economic in this getting back to basics thing?
Oh, I see a big value. I see a big value in the fact that we're bringing manufacturing, albeit small to start, back to American shores.
What do you think, though, about the other end of the lifestyle spectrum? And I'm talking here about, you know, Blake Lively and Gwyneth Paltrow with Goop and all that. I mean, everybody's getting into it now.
Well, I don't think everybody's getting into it, but I think that...
Well, when you've got a website called Goop, I think everybody's in.
Oh. I don't know what Goop means, actually.
Me neither, but...
Gwyneth has been a tremendously successful Oscar-winning actress. She is beautiful. She loves food. She has a family. She is she's interested in the home and the surroundings of the home. And she wants to have some sort of business that deals with all of those things, just as I did 25 years ago when I started the magazine. I didn't know I wanted a lifestyle business, mm-hmm. and I didn't know it was going to be called the lifestyle category at the time.
You know, that's so interesting because you've always struck me as a really intentional person. And I'm sorry to jump in here, but really, my guess is that when you came out with that first book, Entertaining, in 1982, you were like, here's where it's going to go, and I'm going to build this empire, and we're going to do A, B, C, and D. Ready, begin.
It didn't happen quite as clearly as that. It was much more clear to me when I started the magazine, which was about, 1990. So 9 years after I wrote my first book, Entertaining, and I wrote like 9 books after that before I started the magazine. The magazine made it much clearer to me that there was a void in the marketplace. And so we started to do it. And then I noticed that it was also a very synergistic business, a business that could involve television, books, internet. All of that could be brought into this lifestyle business.
Right. And it is very crowded now, in part because of you, right? I'm just going to read off a list of stuff that you're doing. And I should say, before we actually started recording this interview, you were on your own radio show taking call-ins. I mean, you've got right? I mean, you've got Martha Stewart Living, Martha Stewart Weddings, MarthaStewart.com, Martha Stewart's Cooking School on PBS, Martha Live. I mean, it's a lot of what's out there lifestyle-wise is
Martha Stewart Collection at Macy's.
Well, let's not miss anything, right?
Stewart at Home Depot. Martha Stewart at PetSmart.
Okay, there you go.
We have thousands of products. And
so you see my point.
Yes, this is a lifestyle business. It is. And I think you can fairly say I spawned or laid an egg that has turned into a lifestyle industry. And because I've built it into a billion-dollar business – why not, as a Gwyneth or a Blake or many, many other talented younger people want to do the same thing?
Do you worry at all that partly as a result, we are as a society buying part of our identity, part of our lifestyle?
Buying part of our lifestyle.
Yeah. We can go to the store and we can buy what you recommend or what...
Well, there are two kinds of people. Two kinds of people. There are the dreamers who go and buy, and there are the doers who go and make. And I've always recognized that. So the dreamers are what support our company because they will buy the product that they could make if they wanted to, had time to, or were so inclined to, or they can dream about it and figure out how to make it themselves. And we've made life easier. We've made life certainly nicer. And I think, as Steven Spielberg put it to me, he met me on the street one day and he said, I just want you to know
He stopped you on the street?
He did. He's actually lives across the street from me.
There you go. Okay.
So I bump into them sometimes. But he said to me, Martha, he said, I just want you to know that what I think. I think that you have elevated the job of the homemaker from something that we all thought of was kind of drudgery to something much more of an art form. That was, to me, the highest compliment that anybody has paid me, because it is. It should be. You should feel good about making your home nicer for your family and your friends. You should feel great about cooking a good dinner, creating a beautiful birthday party. It's all part of life.
There is a question to be asked here about you and the company and the brand that is you. And it has to do with your conviction for filing false statements in an insider trading case about 10 years ago. You went to prison. You were barred from a role in your company for 5 years. You have since obviously returned. The question is...
Oh, only barred from an executive...
An executive role in the company. Yes. That is true. And you have returned now as non-executive chairman or chairwoman, I suppose. The question is, what does it feel like for a person and a company who is so wrapped up in each other. What does it feel like for you to have that taken away?
Well, it was never really taken away. It was delayed for a period of time. So it was never – you can't really separate the person from the brand. But what I'm hoping, and I think we're succeeding in, is that we've made a brand much, much, much bigger and more important than the person. And that the person, me, is guiding the brand until the next person can guide the brand. Just like the great companies, the Estee Lauders of the world, the Macy's. There used to be an R.H. Macy. Guess what? Uh-huh. He's not here anymore. But boy, look at that company. Much, much bigger than he ever thought. Same thing with Sam Walton. That's what I would like to have as a heritage. And certainly I'm trying to build a company that is respected, desirable, happy, and productive. And that's really what I'm looking for. And I think we're doing it. I mean, we certainly make a lot of people happy and around their home. That's why my company is called Living, because it's all about what we do every day.
I think all I need to say here by way of identification is Martha Stewart. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, it's a question, the answer to which I will just go ahead and tell you in advance is no. The question is, do national parks need Wi-Fi? Again, the answer clearly is no. The item appeared today on Mashable. Apparently, Park Service officials are considering a $34 million plan to run fiber optic cable through Grand Teton National Park into Yellowstone. So listen, how about we do this? How about we all just put the phones away and just look around? Would that be all right? Yeah, that's what I thought. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 24 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 8 points, nearly 0.2%. The S&P 500 pretty much flat. Our daily production team is Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Stacey Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM and Just Say No.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.